Chapter 31. The physical search of the area was described four separate ways in four separate files, the first from the county PD, the second from the state police, the third from the National Guard's helicopter unit, and the fourth from the FBI. The helicopter report was thin and useless. Margaret Coe had been wearing a green dress, which didn't help in corn country in early summer, and the pilot had stayed above 1,000 feet to stop his downdraft damaging the young plants. Priorities had to be observed in a farm state, even when a kid was missing. Nothing significant had been seen from the air. No freshly turned earth, no flash of pink or chrome from the bike, no flattened stalks in any of the fields. Nothing at all, in fact, except an ocean of corn. A waste of time and aviation fuel. Both the county PD and the state police had covered the 40 farms at ground level. First had come the loudhailer appeals in the dark, and the next day every house had been visited, and every occupant had been asked to verify that they hadn't seen the kid and that they had searched their outbuildings thoroughly. There was near universal cooperation. Only one old couple confessed they hadn't checked properly, so the cops searched their place for themselves. Nothing was found. The motel had been visited, every cabin checked, the dumpster emptied, the lot searched for evidence. Nothing was found. The Duncan compound showed up in three files. Everyone except the helicopter unit had been there. First, the county PD had gone in, then the county PD and the state police together, then the state police on its own, and then finally the FBI, which had been a lot of visits and a lot of people for such a small place. The searches had been intense because the smallness of the place had struck people as somehow sinister in itself. Richard could sense it between the lines quite clearly, even a quarter century later. Rural cops. They had been confused and disconcerted. It was almost like the Duncans hated the land. They had stripped away every inch of it they could. They had kept a single-track driveway, plus token shoulders, plus a grudging 5 or 10 yards beyond the foundations of their three houses. That was all. That was the whole extent of the place. But the smallness had made it easy to search. The reports were meticulous. The piles of heavy lumber for the half-built fence had been taken apart and examined. Gravel had been raked up, and lines of men had walked slow and bent over, staring at the ground, and the dogs had covered literally every square inch 10 times each. Nothing was found. The search moved indoors. As intense as it had been outside, it was twice as thorough inside. Absolutely painstaking. Reacher had searched a lot of places, a lot of times, and he knew how hard it was. But 4 times in quick succession, not a single corner had been cut, and not a single effort had been spared. Stuff had been taken apart, and voids in walls had been opened up, and floors had been lifted. Reacher knew why. Nothing was stated on paper, and nothing was admitted, but again, he could read it right there between the lines. They were looking for a kid, certainly, but by that point they were also looking for parts of a kid. Nothing was found. The FBI contribution was a full-on forensic sweep, 1980s style. It was documented and described at meticulous length on sheets of bureau paper that had been photocopied and collated and stapled and passed on as a courtesy. Hairs and fibers had been collected, every flat surface had been fingerprinted, all kinds of magic lights and devices and gadgets had been deployed. A corpse-sniffing dog had been flown in from Denver and then sent back again after producing a null result. Technicians with 12 different specialist expertises had been in and out for 12 solid hours. Nothing was found. Reacher closed the file. He could hear it in his head right then, the same way they must have heard it all those years ago. The sound of a case going cold. 60 miles north, Dorothy Coe was standing at her sink, washing her plate and her knife and her fork and her glass, and scrubbing the oven dish that her chop had cooked in. She dried it all with a thin linen towel and put it all away, the plate and the glass in a cupboard, the silverware in a drawer, the oven dish in another cupboard. She put her napkin in the trash and wiped her table with a rag and pushed her chair in neatly. Then she stepped out to her front parlor. She intended to sit the spell and then go to bed and then get up early and drive to the motel. Maybe she could help Mr. Vincent fix the mirror behind his bar. Maybe she could even glue the handle back on his NASA mug. Richard sat a spell on the floor in his Marriott room, thinking. It was 10 o'clock in the evening. His job was done, 2 hours ahead of his pretended midnight schedule. He got to his feet and packed up all 11 cartons and folded their flaps into place. He stacked them neatly in the center of the floor, 2 piles of 4 and 1 of 3. He dialed 9 for a line from the bedside table, and then he dialed the switchboard number he remembered from the transcript of Dorothy Coe's original panic call 25 years earlier. It was still an active number. It was answered. Reacher asked for Hoag, not really expecting to get him, but there was a click and a second of dead air, and then the guy himself came on. "I'm done," Reacher told him. "Find anything?" "You guys did a fine job. Nothing for you to worry about, so I'm moving out." "So soon? You're not staying for the nightlife?" "I'm a simple soul. I like peace and quiet." "Okay, leave the stuff right there. We'll swing by and pick it up. We'll have it back in the basement before the file jockeys even get in tomorrow. They'll never know a thing. Mission accomplished." "I owe you," Reacher said. "Forget it," Hoag said. "Be all you can be and all that shit." "The chance would be a fine thing," Reacher said. He hung up and grabbed his coat and headed for the door. He was way in the back of the H-shaped layout, and he had to walk all the way forward to the lobby before getting outside and looping back around to where his car was parked. The stairs came down from the second floor just before the lobby, in a space that would have been another room in the wing if it had been a one-story structure. Just as Reacher got to them, a guy stepped off the last stair and fell in alongside him, heading the same way, to the lobby, to the door. He was one of the guys Reacher had seen checking in at the desk. Small and rumpled, unshaven, Iranian, possibly. The guy glanced across. Reacher nodded politely. The guy nodded back. They walked on together. The guy had car keys swinging from his finger. A red tag. Avis. The guy glanced at Reacher again, up and across. Reacher glanced back. He held the door. The guy stepped out. Reacher followed. The guy looked at him again, some kind of speculation in his eyes, some kind of intense curiosity. Reacher stepped left to loop around the length of the H on the outside. The Iranian guy stayed with him, which made some kind of possible sense after Reacher glanced ahead and saw 2 cars parked back there. Seth Duncan's Cadillac and a dark blue Chevrolet. Prime rental material. Avis probably had thousands of them.